gather around. I'm glad everybody came out tonight. As we stand on our neighborhood corner, know that this fire that's burning represents the passion you have. Listen. I recognize all of you. Every creed and color. With that being said,
we had.
Say what?
Now beat that.
Oh, yeah!
Now what we want you all to do is sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. Sit back, y'all. And just relax, y'all. And if you dig it, let me hear your finger snap, y'all.
Now, before I finish, let me just say, I did not come here to show out. Did not come here to impress you. Because to tell you the truth, when I leave here, I'm gone. And I don't care what you think about me. But just remember, when it hits the fan, brother, whether it's next year, 10 years, 20 years from now, you'll never be able to say that these brothers lied to you, Jack.
Okay, I'll reload it.
From the sports bars to the stands, we are the voice of the fans. You are now plugged into your sports mixtape. This is the Section 357 show, the Ball Street Journal. And you're here with your Ball Street Journal reporters, Big Shot Ron and myself, Floyd. Ron, how you doing, man?
We are in sort of the dog days of August leading into September. So we're spraying the all field, to use a baseball term. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about Straight Outta Compton, the big hit release biographical movie on NWA. We're going to talk a little bit about hip-hop and celebrating anniversary. What does this mean? What is this relevant? And the hidden competition between fantasy football and the Madden football video game series. But before we get into all that, you got to sit it down somewhere between Turner Field and the Georgia Dome. It's my main man, Floyd. Floyd, what's going on, man?
Feeling good, feeling great. Always a pleasure and a privilege to be able to have this conversation with you and to share it with our fans out there. Find us on Twitter at Section357, as well as online at Section357.com. Big Shot Ron, let's start off with sort of the flash and the sizzle of all of those topics that you talked about. Straight Outta Compton, the biopic of the world's most dangerous group, as they were dubbed, or maybe the world's most dangerous rap group, but in any case, NWA, Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E, MC Ren, and Yella. Big Shot Ron, did the movie live up to the hype to you? Because there was certainly a lot of hype around this release. Did the movie live up to that for you?
It was eye-opening for me, I think, one in the wide-ranging demographic of the NWA fans. You know, we are all late 30s. So when NWA was really at its peak, we were still relatively young as far as being hip-hop fans. We were still adolescents, early teens. So when I went to the movie to see people who are in their 50s, mid-50s at the movie, and then you think, wow, that's about right, though, because NWA, when they first exploded, for people who were born late 50s, early 60s, this was about their time of life. So I think to see that age range at the show was kind of eye-opening for me. And I think it did live up to me. I think there are a lot of people who, you know, very stereotypically in their view, thinking this is going to be almost like Boys in the Hood or Juice. And it really was not that. It was really a really great look at kind of the upbringing of this group, the history. So for me, it lived up to a lot of the expectations. I think for a lot of people, especially mainstream media, were thinking this was going to be gangs and violence and Bloods and Crips and cussing of all movies. I think there was a lot of people, I think, who may have been let down by what they thought they were going to get.
Well, Big Shot Ron, I think there was some of that, but of course, as you mentioned, that was not all that the movie was about. What I got from the movie was, A, there was way too much history to include in 2.5 hours. Online, and I guess on Twitter, if you will, I saw lots of conversation around what was not in the movie, or how come this person's character wasn't represented. And I think so many people, because they were alive during this time frame, were looking for an expansive, exhaustive, sort of complete depiction of everything that happened. And in Hollywood, especially when you have a 2-hour to 2.5-hour window, you're just not going to get that. I know some people were concerned about the treatment of women in the movie. People were asking about certain incidents involving Dr. Dre and maybe some domestic violence incidents he had that were not in the movie. And also, I think, you know, with the cameos that were there, you didn't get a lot of development of those relationships because you only have 2.5 hours. And if you look at the group as a whole, as well as what they did after the fact, I think all in all, the producers, the director, the writers, they did about as well as anyone could have done, I think, given the circumstances that they were playing in. So if it was, you know, a 5-part documentary, maybe. But 2.5 hours, I think they got in about as much as they could have gotten in, and they definitely hit the hot parts.
My thing was, how much of did you really want to see? Like, a lot of people I know were talking about, well, what's more into the Suge Knight aspect of it, or Snoop. And my thing was, they weren't part of NWA. Yeah, they were definitely Keith Rose and hip-hop. But as far as the NWA story, Suge and Snoop, to me, were bit players. How much of that do you really want to see? I think the only part that I think they didn't touch on enough might have been the relationship between Dre and Easy, and how Easy and Ice Cube, and how that whole thing went south, and how south, not only how south went, but how deep it really was. I think that was the only part that they didn't really touch on, maybe to my satisfaction. But as you say, 2.5 hours, you really have to kind of get to the high spots, so to speak. You can't really go into some of the extras, and I'm not surprised that the whole issue with D-Barbs and Dre did not get no mention. That didn't surprise me. I mean, after all, you're talking about a biographical movie. You're really going to show more of the highlights than the lowlights.
Ron, you also have to keep in mind that most of the time when you see a biopic, that person or persons is probably already dead. So, in this case, you have Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, who played major roles in making this movie happen. They're both still alive. So, I was not surprised that they wouldn't go into some of the more personally hurtful moments around their careers and their personal lives. So, you mentioned Dee Barnes. You mentioned some of the other things that maybe didn't get as much coverage. I think that there really wasn't an incentive for Dr. Dre or Ice Cube to air all of their dirty laundry. And then on top of that, one of the things that I think a lot of us overlook, especially because Dre and Cube have had such long solo careers, is that NWA only released 2 albums, at least 2, I guess, quote-unquote, official albums. So they were only together for a relatively brief period of time in hip-hop history relative to the rest of their career. So for everybody who wanted to see more of the big characters, as you called it, for this particular story, the group itself wasn't together long enough to really, warrant bringing in all of the other side characters that may have been part of the individual stories of these guys.
One thing I did find surprising, Floyd, let me get your feedback on this, is the Paul Giamatti played Jerry Heller, NWA's infamous manager, who has been the target of many a tirade and and not so nice things by Cube and Easy and even Dre. But in the movie, to me, they made him look better than what he's been portrayed at over the years. That might have been the most surprising thing I thought in the movie, but that they didn't really go in on Terry Heller to the extent that we remember fans, where he was the constant source and probably rightly of a lot of their anger and frustration. So I think, to me, that was a surprising part of the movie that I saw.
Ron, I think this boils down to how much do you want to pile on to a guy? You look at where Dr. Dre is, you look at where Ice Cube is, they're pretty well off, kind of gotten past that moment in their lives. And I don't think they really wanted to pile on to Jerry Heller. By all accounts, you know, Jerry Heller, you know, isn't as, I guess, well off as many of us probably would think, and is a much older guy. So they probably didn't want to waste time. I don't want to say waste time. They probably didn't want to pile on to an old guy, to be quite honest, at this point in their careers and in his life. And one quick thing before we move on. You've also heard the term, to the victors go the spoils, or in other ways, the winners write history. This movie was really crafted from the perspective of Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, if you ask me. I wonder what the movie would have been like had Ren and Yella been telling these same stories, because you see a lot of Dre and Cube, and kind of see at the end of the movie, those two guys kind of have their big moments going off into the sunset, so to speak. But with Ren and Yella, who were, as we see in the movie, kind of down with Easy until pretty much the end, I wonder what this same movie would have been like had they been the one telling the story.
It reminded me a lot, Florida, of the Five Heartbeats. And if you remember Five Heartbeats, our fans out there remember, it was a lot about Duck, JT, and their relationship. And that's, to me, what this was. Dre, Ice Cube with Duck and JT. You didn't get a lot out of Choir Boy and Dresser, who would have been Ren and Yella. And I think it would have been interesting, I think, if, again, you're talking about 2.5 hours. I think because Dre and Cube and Easy were the front men, you know, they just didn't have a lot of time or space to give some of the perspective of Ren and Yella. But I think it would have been interesting, because I think especially Ren. Ren is someone who is, I don't say the black sheep of the group, but Ren has a very different view of how those days went, as you hear him on interviews. I think him having a little more of the spotlight would have been really interesting. But I think Dre and Cube were sort of the face of this project. You know, Easy was the biggest name. He was the lead. I think they kind of really just fit more that 2.5 hours, making sure that those three and their view was kind of covered.
Well, let's change speeds ever so slightly, but stay in the hip-hop lane. In many ways, this NWA movie was an anniversary of sorts, or at least a chance to recall an earlier time in hip-hop. And these days, especially on social media, we spend a lot of time, or at least I see it quite often, where we like to highlight anniversaries of certain hip-hop releases. You know, it's been 20 years since Wu-Tang first dropped their album, or 20 years since Raekwon put out Only Built for Cuban Links, or 20 years since Outkast put out their first album. So this whole notion of celebrating the milestones in hip-hop, how do you feel about that?
It shows where hip-hop has moved as a mainstream music. You know, rock and roll does this all the time, where they get the 25th album anniversary of the Grateful Dead, or a Paul Simon record, or Garfunkel and Simon, or, you know, rock and roll has done this for decades. I think hip-hop has now moved into that space as a mainstream music, where now we start to celebrate the classics. I do wonder, though, and I put this back to you, is this doing a disservice to some of the current-day music? We know our generation, by and large, I'm talking people in their 30s to early 40s, are not big fans of today's music. You know, this generation of music has slanted young as far as consumer. Do you think it's our generation just sort of holding on to what we had, sort of being the crotchety old man, as my man L.A. Trey would like to say, and sliding the young generation? Or is this just sort of the music evolving into what it's becoming, which is the mainstream music, which gets celebrated?
Ron, I believe it's a lot of all of what you just said. On one hand, I think that on social media right now, the fans of hip-hop who came of age in the 90s are still in that social media prime, if you will. People are very active on social media. They may be in their professional jobs or their professional careers, so to speak, but they're still active on social media, and they can recall way back when, quote-unquote. If you were in your 20s when hip-hop first kind of came about, you're probably not online or involved in the social media conversation to maybe point out some of the earlier releases. But I think that one of the other things about this remembrance of hip-hop is that I see mostly albums getting celebrated that were part of the span of hip-hop once records really started selling. So once hip-hop started to feel and take on a more commercial ambition, if you will, and you had guys going gold, going platinum, I think those are the records and the releases and the songs that had widespread appeal, and people from all over could remember where they were when certain songs and certain CDs came out, so they can talk about it and have that conversation on social media. I think it's going to take, from a younger generation standpoint, having some classic albums. And I think that's harder and harder to do because of how music gets consumed and because record sales really aren't what they, you know, what they used to be. It's hard to have a classic album that everybody kind of agrees on and everybody can sort of take a moment to acknowledge and to celebrate it. So in 20 years, you might get people celebrating a Drake album or a Kendrick Lamar album, but because only a handful of artists really get that widespread commercial appeal, I think it'll be fewer and fewer for the generations to come.
Do you think the days of the classic album are over? If you look at the last 5 to 7 years in hip-hop, it's all been about the mixtape and the EP. You know, whether it's Ross, Drake, Kendrick Lamar, Lil Wayne, pick a guy who's been wildly successful the last 5 to 7 years, it's been the shorter release. Have we moved to that point where that's just not doable anymore? Where the 14-track album, classic album, is basically over, and now it's about shorter releases, you get it out there faster, downloads, iTunes, you maybe produce a couple of hot videos to go with your record, and then going about your business. Is that day sort of lost? Are we just in an extended cycle and that can be brought back?
I think the notion of what a classic album is definitely going to change or has changed over time. One, because to be a classic, I think you have to be able to grab everyone's attention at around the same time to get everybody plugged in to acknowledge that the album came out, that it was great, and that it has some staying power. So if you don't get everyone's attention all at the same time, I think it's hard for albums to get that classic label. So an artist like Kendrick Lamar, when he released To Pimp a Butterfly, a lot of people sort of stopped, paid attention, and digested that album. So you have to be able to grab everybody's attention for a brief moment, at least, to be able to get everybody on board and to sort of give their opinions one way or another on the album. As you mentioned, it's more about getting the singles out, getting the mixtapes out, and hitting the road, going on tour, et cetera, et cetera. So I do believe that this extended cycle that you talked about may become more of a permanent reality because there are just fewer and fewer artists who are really going into the studio with the intent to make a great album. So I can't say that it's dead yet, it's close to it. But as long as there are a handful of artists who can still grab your attention, there's always a chance for it to keep going. But it'll be tough going forward.
Now, as a consumer and as a hip hop fan, do you prefer it this way though? Because if you remember when we were coming out '80s and '90s, a dude come out with a hot album. Nas comes out with, for instance, I Am, like '96, '97. The next project doesn't come out till like Hate Me Now. That Nostradamus, which was like the end of '99 going into 2000. So typically, guys had 2-3 years, or young ladies as well. You had a 2-3 year wait between hot albums. Now you can come out with your stuff almost every couple months with a new record. As a fan, do you prefer that you get the material faster? It's not about quality. Or did you like the sort of anticipatory build? That every once a year, every 2 year project coming out.
I got to be honest. I am enjoying the moment that we're in right now because I look at a guy like Future. I'm a big fan of Future. Future puts out a couple of projects a year, it seems, maybe even more. And he always has, at least now in Atlanta, always has a song on the radio and is just a guy who works extremely hard. So I tend to like guys and ladies. I tend to like artists in general, I'd say, who work hard. And Future works hard. So I can respect that, and I can see why people respond to his music. So if the artist is willing to work hard and put the time in, I'm okay with that, because you have to think about, it's easier to create music nowadays. Most of these guys and ladies have studios while they're on the road on their tour bus, so you can record almost anywhere. So back then, an artist had to take time from the road, go into the studio to create something, stay locked in for 6 weeks to, 2 months, and come out with the project. Where as now, artists can simultaneously be out on the road promoting one project and then working on their next project at the same time, when they're not on stage. So I like how it is now, but for those rare moments when an artist like a Drake or like a Kendrick come out with a project that is going to be a legit album, quote unquote, I still get excited for that too.
Okay. Now, speaking of time frame, we know every year at this time, Madden is going to release a new video game. They are like clockwork. Every year, early August, mid-August, you can set your watch by, here comes the new Madden. And we talked about this in the pre-show meeting. Madden versus fantasy football and this sort of underlying competition. Well, let's talk about sort of the genesis of this conversation, because the Madden trailer was released this week, a 5-minute long form trailer, almost like you were going to see a new Transformers movie or a new Mission Impossible. So let's talk about your views on this long form trailer, which I have never seen for any video game, even some of the action games or Call of Duty. I've never seen this type of a trailer before. So talk about that.
I think that EA Sports, the folks that produce Madden, are feeling the pressure. They are feeling the pressure to have to compete with the conversation online, on social media, and in the streets, quite honestly, when it comes to football and pop culture and everything else. So because the media landscape is so fragmented, they have to go bigger and go all out and spend major money to create something that people will talk about to get that attention. Because right now, fantasy football has grown exponentially, it seems, year on year in terms of that attention for the football fan, or I guess the sort of alternate football universe, if you will. So I think Madden, quite rightfully so, feels the pressure and felt as though they had to up the ante, if you will, to get everyone to talk about their game and pay attention in the moment.
What I found interesting about that trailer, Floyd, and I don't know if you really paid this too much attention, I thought the selection of who they picked to be in this trailer was interesting. You know, you have a couple guys who are like sketch comedy. Kevin Hart has an appearance. I think there's Rex Ryan, Julio Jones, Colin Kaepernick. I thought it was a really hodgepodge group they picked. Like, I didn't see the connection, especially, like, for instance, I think Rex Ryan is like the coach. But Rex Ryan, we all know, not to get too football-y, is very defensive minded. He's not someone who, as a football fan, excites me to play Madden, which is very much about scoring. I thought it was weird, too. And I wonder if Madden is trying to figure out not only the media space, but it's space in video games. Madden, you talk to people who play Madden on a regular basis, they will tell you Madden has pretty much been the same game the last 5 to 8 years with a couple of bells and whistles thrown in it. But it's pretty much been about the same game. And I wonder if they have run out of ideas with the game itself and are now kind of using their branding of that franchise and the trailer to sell this game when they haven't come up with anything new for the actual game.
What else could they really do to the game? Well, to be fair, they probably could go super high-end with it, but that might take the game beyond a certain price point, and maybe that's not attractive for them either because it may be too expensive. But I think that Madden the game is what it is. And when you compare that to the growth of fantasy football, I think that fantasy football has brought in so many fringe, casual, and hardcore fans because you don't have to be a really diehard football fan to play fantasy football. If you want to play Madden, you have to be a bit of a gamer to a certain extent, and maybe that's a tad bit prohibitive to certain people. So the barrier to entry for fantasy football is lower. And while Madden probably has not peaked per se, they probably are on a long-term plateau. Whereas fantasy football, I think, as simple as the sort of setup of fantasy is gaining steam because everybody can play.
I wonder if this doesn't get to where the gambling tide comes into this. And obviously, there are people who play Madden online across the world. They have different, like, regional tournaments. I remember back when we were in college, Floyd, we used to go to the Shark Bar on Monday night with our man L.A. Trey. He would compete in Madden tournaments, but you haven't seen the gambling tie that is with fantasy football. We know fantasy football is a billion-dollar industry. And is this where gambling separates the two? Because we know the NFL and gambling go hand in glove. So does Madden really have to find a way to tie into gambling to make this thing grow for a game that possibly has plateaued?
I think that fantasy football has gotten so big that Madden would probably be smart to try to integrate the fantasy aspect into some level of what it does. I'm not sure if they've already done it. I'm not sure how they could do it, but maybe some sort of third dimension of fantasy football and Madden, because I think that the gambling part of what you talked about with fantasy will continue to push it further and further. Now you have the daily or the weekly leagues in fantasy where you don't have to have the same guys for the whole season, and you don't have to have, you don't have to be in the same league for the whole season. You can do a lot of short-term fantasy transactions, which, again, appeals to that gambling. So I'm not sure if gambling outright is what Madden has to try to get into, but maybe fantasy football as a segue into that could be a smart solution.
Right, and I think that's where fantasy football kind of beats Madden, is that in fantasy football, you can change your team on a weekly basis. Remember, in the old days of fantasy football, you know, you draft a team, that's your team for the entire year. And while that league is still very much prevalent, with these weekly and daily leagues, if my team is bad, I could just change it next week and try to win money. And I think what Madden has to tap into, as you said, is if the game itself is plateaued and there's nothing else we can do with the game, I think Madden has to find a tie-in, if not to gambling, they might have to find tie-in to real-time NFL. And that maybe brings that game to the next level. But I think fantasy football, I think, definitely has sort of won over the Madden, has won over part of that Madden crowd. Because there's now a financial tie-in other than just simply buying the game. I think people always are going to want to win money. And until they find a way in Madden to let people win money, other than in some regional tournament, the fantasy football factor, I think, is going to continue to grow where Madden itself kind of plateaued.
Well, Big Shot Ron, what has not plateaued is the Section 357 show. This episode is drawing down to a close, but Big Shot Ron, before we close out, do you have any final thoughts on hip-hop, on NWA, on fantasy, on Madden? Any final thoughts before we close out this show?
Floyd, talk about being a big fan of Future. Dirty Sprite 2 released, wildly successful. And in today's hip-hop culture, where the street, as you talk about, have become the consumer. You have your J. Cole's, your Kendrick Lamar's, your Drake's, but really the street music has become so prevalent in the game right now. Is this another question of cycle? And the reason I ask is because I was watching BET on Sun. They were talking about Kid and Play. And Kid and Play were definitely a different type of group. They were a group that also kind of got phased out by the streets once the NWAs and the Wu-Tangs and that group came along. Are we in an era, Floyd, where the streets have officially become the mainstream and the industry norm now, hip-hop? Or is there going to come a day where we cycle back through and your quote-unquote, your backpackers, like we had back in the day, some of your more what you would call your lyrical rap, whatever you want to determine, that becomes the industry norm? Because it seems like now the streets have really taken over this industry. What do you think?
To put it shortly, Big Shot Ron, yes. The street music is the mainstream right now. And I could not have imagined a moment in time where that would be the case. But going back into the history of hip-hop where a group like NWA was the outlier, I think the street music nowadays is main wave in hip-hop, at least commercial hip-hop. I know some people may have some sort of backlash response to that in terms of all of hip-hop, but I think in terms of mainstream hip-hop, the street music is the norm. So I don't know if it's a long-term cycle or a new reality, if you will, but there's always room for creative artists. You know, there's always room for folks who are willing to be different and willing to be bold and willing to kind of march to their own drum and kind of go a different way. So whenever the artists come out that are brave enough and courageous enough to do that and have good music, they'll find success as well. So I think it's just a matter of the artists themselves wanting to maybe go a different route. And speaking of that, the street music and the anniversaries, a big anniversary locally here in Atlanta was the 10-year anniversary of Young Jeezy's Thug Motivation. A lot of people were excited about that particular moment. He had a concert and brought out everybody who was on the record, performed it all in one take, so to speak, if you will. I did not attend. I was not able to get there. But from what I heard, it was a really exciting affair. And I think that you're going to see more of that. As we talk about artists going on tour, getting these festival checks, if you are an artist who has had any sort of success in the past where you might be able to have an anniversary moment, the anniversary tour or the anniversary concert is a pretty big financial gain. So expect to see more of these anniversary concerts, if you will, because I think they bring in a pretty penny. With that being said, this has been the Section 357 show, the the Ball Street Journal. Check us out on Twitter at Section 357 as well as on Section357.com. You heard Big Shot Ron earlier. I'm Floyd. Until next time, take care.